Great. Good morning. With what I realized is that the homework I gave you last week might have been a bit too ambitious to get it ready by next week, Tuesday. So I think I'll just give you another week. So it will be due the Tuesday after spring break. And then we'll have a little bit more covered, which might make some of the problems a bit easier. In the current homework, I'm quite happy with what you did. I thought I'd just briefly talk about problem 9 and 11, because I think these were the hardest ones. But if you have other problems you would like me to elaborate about, please don't be shy in saying so. So, problem 9 was to look at, so we have a group G which has a unique block system. B, and unique by size of the blocks. Okay. And that is, of course, a subgroup of S, let's say Sn, and it's transitive. Ben, so the current homework is due 1 week later. Not next Tuesday, but the Tuesday after, which is actually the Tuesday after spring break.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, which due in spring break?
I'm not here, but you need to come and put it. And I will not take it earlier. Okay. So, suppose the group has a block system which is unique by size of the blocks. And one could even make it more specific, not just size of the blocks, but type of the action on the blocks and so on. Well, and let's say we take the normalizer, N shall be the normalizer in Sn of the group G. Okay. Then N acts on G by permutation, by conjugation, and N consists of permutations which map the points around. That's just because it's not just it's a normalizer in Sn, we have permutations. And basically the crucial observation is that if we look for an element little n in the normalizer, let's define B to the n be the set of all images. Okay, this is a set of sets, and now I'm taking the, well, if I have a group acting on points, I have an action on sets, and then I also have an action on sets of sets, and of sets of sets of sets, and so forth. Right, so what I'm taking is, I'm taking the images of all the sets, all the blocks under N, where these are blocks, in the block system. Okay. And I claim this is a block system. For G. Okay. Why is this the case? Well, I start with a partition. If I have a partition of the points 1 to n, and I real number the points, that's what n just does. I have again a partition. Okay, that comes for free. Okay, why is it a block system for G? Well, because, so partition comes for free. Why is it G invariant? So let's take one set in there. Let B to the n be an element of this image, or beta to the n. Okay, and I take the image of this. So, and I take an element little g in G. Now if I take the image of beta under n, and now I take the image of this under G, what is this? This is the same as beta under G under some other element. What do I want to say? I want, of course, the same element in. G is the normal one, and that's the thing where I made the mistake. N is, normally N is a normal subgroup, and that's where I got what I also have. Beta to the N and take the image under G, that's of course the same as beta under the product in G. Okay, N normalizes G. So what does this mean? This means that N inverse GN is some element G tilde, right? Or I can write it differently, I can put the inverse on the other side just to make it a bit more convenient. I can make it NG, N inverse is some G, and now we'll do the tilde the other way around. Okay, so that means simply that NG is G tilde N, right? So this is the same as beta to the G tilde N. Okay, I can put parentheses here. What is beta to the G tilde? That is because this script B was a block system. This is a block in the block system script B. And if I take the image of this under N, it is a set in the image of this block system. Right? So what this shows is that and that is something which holds generically. If I have the normalizer in the symmetric group or something which normalizes a group, it must map a block system to a block system. And clearly it's a block system with blocks of the same size. I've renumbered the points and sets. The set cardinalities stay the same. Right? So, this is a block system. But because of the uniqueness, it means that script B to the N is equal to script B. Must be the same block system, because I assumed the group has no other one of that size. Okay. So, what does this mean? It means N maps this block system, this partition script B, to the partition script B. So it preserves that partition. So that means script B is a block system for the normalizer N. The normalizer also must preserve the block system. And in general, that is not true. In general, you can have an imprimitive group where the normalizer is primitive. That can happen. But in this particular case, it cannot. Because the block system itself must be preserved. Okay, and now we basically could use the embedding theorem for N. We could say, okay, then N embeds into a Reith product. And then if we ask what kind of Reith product, what's the action on the block? The action of a block stabilizer of N on its block must stabilize the action of G on its block. That's again normalizing property. I'm just intersecting with a block stabilizer. And that gives us the statement in the theorem, in the exercise. Okay? Right. The other problem I briefly want to say something about is problem 11, which probably conceptually was a little bit tough if you're in your second semester, second graduate semester, and might just barely have had a little bit of Galois theory. So, what basically the question is, what happens? Well, you can look at it from two ways. You can look at it from the question of what does it mean to have subfields, or what does it mean that to have a polynomial which is a composition of polynomials. So you might have seen this even in school, that you have quadratic equations, well, and then there are formulas for cubic and quartic equations which are horrible. But if you have a quadratic equation, you have another quadratic equation. Then you can solve it twice by basically solving two quadratic equations. That can happen. If you have x to the 4 minus 2, then your solution is a square root of a square root of 2. Okay. And you can ask more generally, what happens if you compose a quadratic polynomial with another quadratic polynomial? You get a polynomial of degree 4. But if you actually look at what happens with the coefficients, you find there is some dependency in the coefficients. That's not a universal polynomial of degree 4. If you try it out, you will see there is some dependency. Okay. Well, it turns out that the natural way actually is not necessarily pure composition, but divides the composition. And the divide, that is not as nice, but that is basically because of a technical issue. So we have the situation, we have f is a polynomial. I set over the rationals. There is nothing special about the rationals here. It's just, didn't want to say perfect field, which is irreducible. And I think, did I call it alpha as a root of, or did I give it a name at all?
No. I used alphas.
I think I used alphas too. But
yeah, I mean, everybody uses alphas, but
not in particular.
Alpha and in the complex numbers, so that f of alpha is 0, and I have k is the field q if I adjoin alpha, and that is isomorphic to qx modulo the ideal generated by this polynomial. Okay. And now, do you mind if I borrow your sheet? Just so I knew, I should have brought this. So the action on the roots you all had. So the question is the Galois group being imprimitive, or was K the splitting field? Oh, K was the splitting field. So let's. So K is the splitting field of F, and that is of course contained. That contains Q alpha. Okay, in the Galois correspondence, we need to stand on our head. So in the Galois correspondence, the splitting field corresponds to the trivial group, the rationals correspond to the whole group, and this will correspond to the point stabilizer, the stabilizer in the Galois group of this root alpha, right? K corresponds to the trivial subgroup. Okay. So, it's the point stabilizer, and so we could look at this permutation action. The permutation action is imprimitive if and only if I have a subgroup in between. That's something we've proven. Imprimitivity corresponds to subgroups between the point stabilizer and the whole group. So we have some other subgroup in here. That subgroup exists if and only if G is imprimitive. Okay, so what does it mean that such a subgroup exists? Subgroup which contains the stabilizer in the Galois group of alpha and is contained in the Galois group, and I want it to be a proper sum. What does this mean? By the Galois correspondence, this corresponds to a field, right? such a subgroup exists that corresponds to a subfield, that's the Galois correspondence, and by the primitive element theorem, and that's again where it's most convenient to do the rationals, though that also would hold for finite fields, just not for infinite fields and finite characteristic, corresponds to a subfield. So I can consider that subfield as the rationals with some element beta adjoint. Okay. So my situation is I have the rational numbers here, I have the field with beta adjoint, and I have the field with alpha adjoint, and Galois correspondence would be the Galois group, this subgroup U, and here I have the stabilizer of alpha. Okay, and now what can I do with this field Q beta? And I mean, some of you had ideas to form the blocks directly. And basically, that will work if the polynomial really is a perfect decomposition. But in some cases, that does not work. And it does not work because what could happen is that your, say, your sum over the blocks, over the roots in one block, happens to add up to zero. So, for example, take a polynomial, irreducible polynomial of degree 3, x cubed plus x plus 1 probably will work. I mean, irreducible polynomial, you basically write one down and you avoid the most obvious traps and you have probability 1 that it is irreducible. So, you would take x cubed plus x plus 1, and I think that is irreducible. It should be because it's irreducible modulo 2. Right?
Yeah.
And if it was in degree 3 to be irreducible, it's sufficient to not have a root. Or we could just try even the rational root theorem. There are several ways we can prove that this is irreducible. And now I substitute x squared for x. Okay. So I get x to the 6 plus x squared plus 1. Okay. And so my decomposition is with x squared. What will happen with the roots of this polynomial with respect to the roots of this polynomial? The roots here are simply that I take the roots here and I take their two roots, right? But if I have a square root, the two roots just change, differ by a sign. So if I take these two roots, and these two roots will be the 2, 1, 2 in a block. So if I take the sum over the roots in a block, I happen to get zero. Not because it generically has to be zero, but because it doesn't work for this particular case. Because something is, okay, I could say instead of taking the sums, I'm taking the products. But again, if you do these things in some way, you can be unlucky that these combinations fall in a smaller subfield for essentially reasons of bad luck. So what you can do is either in this case you can try to rescue it to say, oh, I transform my initial polynomial, I twiggle a bit with the coefficients, or I twiggle, replace a root, replace x by x plus 1 or something, or some rational function in x, so that I define the same field, and one can show generally this will work to avoid these degeneracies. Okay, but that's a little bit messy. So at this point, basically, I'm just saying that's something we can't avoid. We need to be a little bit more careful. So what can I do here? Beta is a polynomial which is an element which is algebraic over Q. So let G be the minimal polynomial over Q of beta. Right? That must exist. And this is a polynomial of degree strictly smaller than the degree of f, because the degree is the degree of the field extension,
And this field extension is strictly of smaller degree than this field extension because I wanted a proper subgroup, right? So the degree of G is strictly smaller than the degree of F. Okay, good. That gives me the one polynomial. How do I get the other polynomial? Well, beta is an element of Q alpha. Okay, what are the elements of Q alpha? By the way, how it was originally defined, maybe using this construction here, the elements are polynomials in alpha with rational coefficients, right? So, I can write there exists a polynomial H in Q, no field extension. So, a polynomial with rational coefficients such that beta is H of alpha. I can write it as a polynomial in alpha, and that is just the property lying in that field. Any element in Q alpha can be written as such a polynomial in alpha, because it can be written as a linear combination of 1 alpha, alpha square, alpha cubed, and so forth. Okay? And what can I tell about the degree of H? The degree of H, again, is strictly smaller than the degree of F, because if the degree, the polynomial, I don't need polynomials of degree of F, because in that degree I have the minimal polynomial of alpha, which has value 0. Right? So any polynomial of bigger degree, actually, I could, in alpha, I could reduce with getting rational numbers to a polynomial of smaller degree. Okay, and now I just observe that G of H of alpha, that's just G of beta, and that is 0. The first equality is definition of H, the polynomial which gives me beta. The second equality is that G is the minimal polynomial of beta. Right? So, G of H of X is a polynomial which has alpha as a root, but F is the minimal polynomial of alpha. So, I can conclude that F must divide F of X must divide G of H of X. And vice versa, it works exactly the same way, just the other way around. Well, it's not exactly the same. So if you can write F as a divisor of two such polynomials, you just say, take your first polynomial of the polynomial G of smaller degree, that will define a field extension. And that field extension must lie in Q alpha because a root of this polynomial is H of alpha. So that gives you this correspondence both ways around. Yes, and it corresponds to a block system of the action on the roots. And that is actually something which can be used and is used concretely for finding subfields in algorithms. The imprimitivity is used there. Okay, right, so this was basically a homework problem for our number theorists. Or number theorists. Mm-hmm. Okay, right. Any other questions about the homework? I mean, yeah, problem 12 is basically the structure of the pseudo subgroups of symmetric groups. That's something which is sometimes useful to know. And otherwise, I don't think there was anything specific. I've made a few remarks in grading, but they were all really minor things. Yeah, any other questions?
So I was trying to run the app for A6C2, and it's been running for 8 hours, probably okay, 10 hours by now.
That's the same.
And
that is really
strange. It worked for A5C2.
Okay.
And that ran in about 10 minutes.
Okay. Probably. Right. I tried this on my computer, and the version installed might be slightly old. there is an improvement in the subgroup algorithm, which exactly affects these kinds of groups. And the improvement is basically saying before it's some more naive search, and now it's realizing that subgroups of A6 cross A6 must be subdirect products of subgroups. And that's why it takes so long. And I tried it out, and it took on my computer with a newer version, it took a minute or two. But yes, that's the reason why that takes that long. And why for if, sorry, yeah, I, that's my fault.
I think you also, you told me that there is a better way to put in, to write your groups. So that
yes, and the other thing, and the other thing which could happen is depending how you create the wreath product. So if you say wreath product between alternating group 6 and then you say cyclic group 2, what get will do is it will represent the cyclic group by default not as a permutation group.
Yeah.
And it does that because if someone wants to have a cyclic group of order, I don't know, 20 million, you can still work very easily in that group. But as a permutation group, it would be unhandy. Okay, so it basically represents it as words in certain symbols. So, and if you then form the wreath product, GAP says, okay, I'm right keeping the elements in the form as they are, and forms a generic wreath product, so a set of tuples. And what you want to do is you want to have the wreath product as a permutation group. So what you need to do is you need to do the wreath product between the alternating group on 6 letters, okay, and then you do a cyclic group. Yes, and I should have written this in the problem. And now you force it to be a permutation. You say is perm group, comma, 2. And the reason I didn't spot this, because this is so much to type. What I typically do is I just type group 1, 2, and then it is a permutation group. Yep. And I didn't think about, yes, there is a cyclic group. I mean, if I tend to live more in a permutation group world. And there the cyclic group command is used. It's there you really, really want to write down the permutations directly. And that's why I didn't spot it. Sorry.
So when I was putting in, so the wreath product wouldn't let me put in just alternating
groups
and cyclic group 2, but I use the standard wreath product
and yes.
put those in. So that's
yes, and then it still does the same thing. Yes, okay. Initially wreath product accepted this, and some users had trouble because it's not always clear what permutation action you want here. Mm. And then there is a function. Therefore, we split up that wreath product will barf, but there is a function standard wreath product which takes the regular action here. But it takes the regular action, but it isn't clever enough. Well, it depends what you want to do. You could say, why doesn't it, if it has the permutation action, just write down the permutation? Because some people really want to keep the elements as tuples. They want to see how do they decompose as semi-direct product of a direct product with something else. Yeah. And that's why I ran into that problem. Sorry. Other questions?
I guess just like wasn't sure what you were getting at with the last one, because I did figured out everything else after we talked and got all this stuff, but I wasn't sure what you meant by it. Because what we're looking at.
Okay. So what does it tell?
Okay.
So for the auto. For A, what does it tell you about the automorphism group of A6 and the automorphism group of A6? So if you use it this way, what you will happen, you will find three groups which have three non-isomorphic groups which have such a structure.
Four.
One is the direct product. Because one is the direct product.
It's four, but there's a little bit of weirdness on the sheet that you gave us, because Two of them do have the same number of conjugacy classes, but are not isomorphic.
Oh, they are not yet. Okay.
These are four distinct groups, but you can't tell that just from reading off the number of conjugacy classes.
No, I thought two of them are isomorphic. No.
One and three are isomorphic. Two and four are not, but they have the same number of conjugacy classes.
Okay. I think the idea was to say, call the number of conjugacy classes reduces the number of isomorphisms. Mm. You don't need to do five choose two isomorphism tests. You only need to do two.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, you can get other properties. It's just at this point, the calculating another property takes longer than to do the other isomorphism test. So you will get four groups which have that structure. And one of them must be a direct product. Okay, that's because the direct product has such a structure. So what you get is you have A6, and I mean all lies in this bigger wreath product. That's the nice thing about the embedding theorem. So we can have look at different extensions and we can actually put them together because all lies in one larger group. If you have abstractly groups of certain structure, it's the question, how can you put them together? Here we just say we put them, it's the same as saying when doing Galois theory, we take the root in the complex numbers. Then we know there is one big field where everything lives and we don't need to worry about how different things interplay. So we have A6 here. Okay. And now we can look at the different groups we're getting. So one of the groups clearly must be S6. Okay. One of them must be an A6 cross C2. Okay, but I get four in total, so I get three other ones. Sorry, I get two other ones. And these two other ones, this S6 would be an A6 semi-direct product with C2, right? This is a different C2 which is involved. But that group is basically the only one which has two normal subgroup, which has a normal subgroup of order 2. Okay. So we get two other groups here, and one can check these two are not direct products. I mean, they're not isomorphic, so they can't. Yeah, so we know already they can't be direct products. So we have two other groups here. Okay. Now I want to look at these three groups together. They will generate something. And they will generate something together. Let's call this, for the moment, let's call this G. And basically the structure G modulo A6 is a Klein 4. That's why I have three subgroups, but they generate together just something which is, again, here I have index 2 and here I have index 1. Okay. So, what can I now tell about this? S6 has index 2 in G, so S6 must be normal in G. That means G will induce by conjugacy automorphisms of S6. And it turns out none of the automorphisms is trivial because, that is probably something one would have to calculate again explicitly, that the centralizer of any of these groups in G is trivial. Okay, why would it have to be trivial? These are normal in G because they have index 2. The centralizer of a normal subgroup would be another normal subgroup. Then I would have another normal subgroup of order 2 in here, and G does not have a normal subgroup of order 2. Okay, so that's why the action by conjugacy on this group is faithful. So I have a group of order not 720 but 1440, which acts faithfully as automorphisms of S6. So the automorphism group of S6 must be larger. In fact, that is the automorphism group of S6, or the automorphism group. And the same holds for A6. So this is the automorphism group of S6, or the automorphism group of A6. And that is the special thing for 6, and that's why I did it for 6 and not for 5. If you do this for 5, you don't get these two other groups. If you do it for 5, you get S5 and the direct product, and that's it. For 6, you get these two other extra groups, which both and together, this gives you a group of order 1440. And, I mean, we haven't proven that it is the whole automorphism. But we can see they act as automorphisms of S6 or as automorphisms of A6 faithfully. So the automorphism group for A6 must be strictly larger than S6. Or S6 must have a non-trivial or outer automorphism. Outer automorphism group is automorphism group modulo the group, modulo inner automorphisms. So typically by outer automorphisms we mean an automorphism which isn't inner. And a non-trivial outer one is yeah, it's just one which isn't inner. Yeah, and we are not seeing that is all. Theoretically there could be more. And for that one would need to prove further. Well, you can probably then look at what would automorphisms do with particular subgroups, and you find there aren't that many. But this is a non-trivial automorphism. It also means we have two other groups here of order 720, which have a structure A6 and a factor group of order 2, but they are not S6. And they don't have generically names. They're subgroups of the automorphism, which are not S6, and there are two of them. And as I mentioned, they are the source of quite a bit sporadic behavior and special behavior in groups and combinatorics. Okay, right. So that was that problem. Other questions? No? So, what I did last time is I started analyzing the structure of a primitive group and I said I wanted the socle. We know the socle must act transitively. We know the socle is T cross T cross T cross T for some simple non-abelian group T. And I wanted that the socle doesn't act regularly, that the point stabilizer is not trivial. And I wanted to analyze how this looks. Okay, given where we are in time, I think what I'm going to do is I will continue with that proof next time and do instead now the construction where this will come to. So basically what the idea of that analysis is, I want to end up with two kinds of constructions for groups which happen to be primitive groups. And so what I need to do is I need to find, I know in my cases, my groups must be subgroups of wreath products, so in some way I need to look at particular permutation actions for wreath products. And, well, we have already seen one permutation action, the imprimitive action, and that is not primitive, so that is not useful. So, can we look at other permutation actions? Okay. So in some way, this is an insert which would come maybe after the theorem, or in the theorem, we will then say, okay, in this case, we must be in this situation. Right. So, we have, let's first look at the socle. And the idea is really, we
we want to take the permutation action of the socle first, that is easier to describe. So in the imprimatur, and let's for the moment just look at a socle with two factors, t cross t. The only reason why I want two factors because that will end up in something two-dimensional. I can still draw on the board easily. So in the imprimative action, let's consider that T is a permit, that we have a faithful permutation action for T, right? So if T is a permutation group, then we can have T cross T on omega. We can have T cross T acts on, well, omega cross the set 1, 2. So we take omega here and we take another copy of omega there. That's the first T and that's the second T, right? And we have it acting intransitively there. So, and that's how the socle, how T cross T acts in the imprimative action of the wreath product T wreath C2, right? That's how we define that imprimative action. The first copy of T acts on the first copy of omega, the second copy of T acts on the second copy of omega. And that gives us the imprimative action. Right, there is another, well, there are basically two other ways how I want T cross T act. Well, there are more which one can do, but basically just two which become interesting. Okay. The first one is what will give rise to something which is called the product action, and in some way actually is even more natural. Right. What is T cross T abstractly? It's a pair, it's the set of pairs, right? It's the Cartesian product of T with T. So, if I have a Cartesian product of groups, where could I ask it to act on? Well, probably on the Cartesian product of the domains. So, for the product action, T cross T acts on omega cross omega. Namely, what is omega cross omega? That's the set of pairs omega 1, omega 2, right? In which way? By saying the pair omega 1, omega 2 acted on by the pair T1, T2 shall be, well, with not much creativity, omega 1 to the T1, omega 2 to the T2. And that is a completely straightforward proof that this is a group action. I mean, this is basically an exercise in writing parentheses. Okay, so that is an action. And it's easy to see, it's a faithful action. So what is omega cross omega? Well, omega cross omega is basically a square where both sides are indexed with omega, right? Omega 1, omega 2 here. And T1 permutes the columns, T2 permutes the rows. And I think we even had this on the first homework sheet. We had that action. I think there we just had one group. If a group acts on a set omega, it will act on the set omega cross omega. Mm-hmm. It's very similar. It's just not one group here. I have two groups and they act separately on rows and columns. Okay. Well, this action is also transitive. Why that? Well, basically because you can get in Manhattan or so, you can get from every street corner to every street corner. You can go, you first to get from here to, or from here to there, you first go along the street to be in the right avenue, and then you go down the avenue, or vice versa. So that action is transitive. Okay, and it's called the product action because it's on the Cartesian product of this. Okay, and this action I can extend to the wreath product. Extend the action to T wreath C2 right? T wreath C2 was T cross T semi-direct product with C2. Okay, what do I want? How can I do this? Or if I want to do this, what should this C2 do? It should exchange the role of the two copies of T. Well, how are they identified in their actions? The one acts on columns, the other one acts on rows. How can we exchange columns and rows? By transposing. This will act by transposing this diagram. Okay, and that action is the product action of the wreath product. So we call this action the product action of the wreath product, where we, and the same thing will. Here I've given you this in some way in an example for two copies. You can do the same with three copies or with n copies. It's just then you can't call it transpose, but you have a permutation of the dimensions. Right? So what we get is definition if A acts fully on omega, B acts on the points 1 up to n. And I'm not calling it delta, I'm calling it the points 1 to n because I find it nicer and easier to actually write it down in the finite case. You can write it down in the infinite case with functions, and then you need to look at these things also as certain functions. But I don't find this easier to work with. It's in some way just for, it's a little bit generality for the sake of generality, unless you really want to go towards infinite permutation groups. Well, then A wreath B acts on, okay, and now what I'm taking is basically omega cross omega cross cross omega, and I'm taking n copies. And in the product action, action in which way? Well, if I take a tuple omega 1, omega 2, up to omega n, and I have it be acted on a1 up to an, comma b, well, so what do I want to do? First, I have a1 act on omega 1, a2 act on omega 2, and so forth. And finally, I want to have b permute the components. So I will get a tuple where I have an omega acted on by an alpha, but which one now we have the same thing, what ends up in the first component? In the first component ends up what B will map into the first component. So the index of this is 1 to the B inverse. Right? And then I have omega 2 to the B inverse acted on by alpha 2 to not be acted on to the B alpha 2 to the B. Here I have the B inverse. So this is a bit an exercise in writing. This is for LaTeX an exercise in writing superscripts and subscripts and so forth.
Curly brace.
Yeah. And that action is called the product action of the wreath product. Okay. In this product action, what is the point stabilizer? A point stabilizer would be the element, say, which fix, and I don't really need to, I can pick whatever point I want, and it's just easier to see if I pick a point which lies on the diagonal. What is the point stabilizer there?
Well, it's the point stabilizer in the columns and the point stabilizer in the rows. So I get the stable point stabilizer in T1, cross point stabilizer in T2, but I can still do the transpose, right? So my point stabilizer becomes a wreath, generically becomes a wreath product of a smaller wreath product, namely the point stabilizer is in this action. This action, a point stabilizer, is the stabilizer in T of some point wreath. Not what did I call it? Oh, I didn't call it. I called it A. The stabilizer in A of some point omega wreath B. And in some way, that actually is a structure which is nicer. If you take the imprimitive action, the point stabilizer is a little bit more messy to describe. It's not hard, but there is more which can happen. This is a very natural relation to the original group, right? So that's one of the reasons why this product action in some way is actually a nice, very nice action for primitive groups. Well, for wreath products. And we will see, even though the degree is bigger in general, this can often be a primitive action. Right. Thank you very much, and I'll see you on Thursday.